Keith, when we last talked, you and your band had just started recording Nine in between tour dates. Would you tell me about the rest of that journey creating your first independently produced album?
Well, it certainly turned out to be a longer journey than I initially anticipated when we spoke. It was one of those things where, you know, one of the beauties of doing it on our own was that nobody was forcing us to finish it, you know, or release it before it was finished. One of the bad parts was nobody was cracking the whip to make us finish it. And as artists can very often be, we are our own worst critics. And so we found ourselves, you know, writing and rewriting and re-recording things. And eventually then we put the foot down and went, all right, we have to pick a day. And we managed to get it finished. And now we're very happy that we did put time in, because I think lyrically and melodically it shows the extra time we did put in. But it was just, you know, everything was brand new. It was like having your first child, where you really, everybody's telling you what to do, but you're trying to do it your way. And, you know, so you fall into the potholes and you climb the mountains till you get to the end of the process. But overall, it worked out great in the end.
Other than perfectionism, which I've yet to meet a musician that didn't say, oh, I wish I could do that better, what was one of the biggest potholes that you and the Dubs fell into creating Nine?
Well, one of the biggest ones, which we should have seen coming and we didn't, was that because we tour so much and because that's our income, we had to keep touring. And that meant that when we were off, our producer wasn't necessarily available. And so a lot of times we would come off the road and say, okay, we're ready, we want to do a couple of weeks in the studio, and he wouldn't be available. So we ended up having to find other places to track, and it meant we widened the family a lot and got a lot more people involved. But ultimately it worked out that, you know, we were able to get it done. But these were problems that, you know, you normally don't have when you just hire a producer for, you know, a three-month project and he makes himself available. Tim Boland, our longtime producer, had to take other jobs because we would be gone for a month on the road and stuff like that. So that was, the logistics were really the hardest part.
That was the hardest part, but what would stand out in your mind as one of the absolute best experiences you had in the creation of Nine?
I think when we realized we had the material, and the material was as strong as it was, that was a huge relief more than anything else, because you never know when you start a project if it is or not. But as always, for me, the biggest relief was doing final mixes, because when you get to final mixes, songs are done, you get to hear them as they're going to be, and you remember where they started from, and you're usually amazed that they ended up where they ended up. But that's always it's a massive, massive celebratory relief time when you suddenly get to listen to the final mixes and realize you pulled it off.
What works for you as a self-critical musician who always says you're trying to improve? How do you get to that point where, okay, that's it?
You know, I'm not sure that you ever really do. I think you have to put that time limit on it, and we basically really shut ourselves down and went, this is it, make your last comments and forever live by them or die by them. So everybody did, and we threw in our last comments, but inevitably when the final mixes were done, we still had, oh, I wish I'd made the snare drum a little louder there, I wish I'd maybe, you know, had a bigger vocal on that one there. But you tell yourself, that's it. You know, I imagine it's similar to sending a kid off to college. You know, you try to prep them as best you can, but once they leave and shut the door behind them, that's it. It's happening.
Let's talk about what's happened with the that's it part of this, because you have some great songs on Nine. Would you tell me the story about creating some of these selections? I personally really like Seeds of Sorrow, but this is up to you.
Yeah, no, anyone you want. Seeds of Sorrow was one of those songs that I'm really happy we had time, because we had the music written for almost everything way, way early on. And usually that's what we do. If it's a song that I write from top to bottom, then usually I'll have a melody idea and I may have a lyric idea. Whereas when it's music written by the band, then I've got the music before I ever get the idea about what it's going to be. And I try to let the music tell me what it's about. So what that involves is playing it over and over again in lots of different situations, you know, especially when you're in your subconscious. So like going to sleep with the song on repeat in my ears, or literally going, you know, walking or working out or just in the van or the bus or a plane, and just literally letting it play over and over again. And ideas came to me and I began to write lyrics, but none of them were exactly what I wanted, and I would sing them out loud to the band, and every now and then, yeah, I really like that line, and I might save that one word, but the actual line, throw away your seeds of sorrow, when it hit me, what I loved about it was the fact that I felt like I'd heard it before. I felt like it was an actual well-known Irish ballad type thing, and that's kind of what you're going for when you do something like this. You want it to be brand new, and you want it to be totally original, but if it has a bit of a lived-in feeling already, then there's a chance that you've nailed something that will go into the psyche of everybody that hears it.
Coming, are you lonely? Drunk in your despair. The cloud that is descending. The battle scars you wear.
So I began to fill out from that line, and you know the line obviously was saying, you know, no more sadness here, come on, let's move on, let's get over this. And so I was able to write the rest of the song around that, and then the minute we played it live, the first time we ever played it, we sang the chorus, and by the second time around, we got to the chorus again, we saw people mouthing the lyric, like as though they thought they'd heard it before as well. So, you know, the beauty of it is it seems to have worked. The bad news would be if I actually find out they heard it before. That wouldn't be so good. But, yeah, so that was one that, you know, it took a long time for it to finally hit me. But when it did, I felt like, wow, I'm glad I waited for this. I'm glad I didn't, you know, force lyrics onto this song initially and waited for something to come into my mind that flowed the way it flows.
It feels familiar because it feels like you're saying, don't take life too seriously. And I feel that way also when I hear you sing We the Mighty.
Yeah, and We the Mighty is an even kind of stranger one because We the Mighty is sort of like a theme that I play with all the time about people, you know, sort of being more confident in themselves and sort of, you know, just, you know, I guess lighten up a little bit, but also, you know, be proud, stand up and be proud. And whatever it is you're doing, it's you and it's, you know, you're one of a kind. And get it out there.
The same old story, just a different generation. But traveling people, a familiar situation. We work so hard, if we can get a job, we know no limitations.
And then it sort of morphed into a song about emigration as well, because when we all arrived out to America all those years ago, it was, you know, what we were greeted with was basically Irish pubs and St. Patrick's Day. And it was very foreign to us because we never celebrated St. Patrick's Day as a party day. It was always a religious day in Ireland. So to see all the shamrocks and the leprechauns and the corned beef and cabbage and, you know, certain things that were a little distressing because it seemed cheesy. You know what I mean? It was kind of our idea of, like, stereotyping us. And then we found out that that's just part of the kind of commercial world that is Valentine's Day, St. Patrick's Day, Christmas, you know, it's just how it's marketed here, but that the people themselves, just, it's a fun day. It's a day for them to get out and have a laugh, and they're very fond of anything Irish that day, and it's become a very successful commercial day for us as well. So I don't knock it, but I wanted to tell the next generation of immigrants, don't worry, that's not what this is when you get here. There's plenty of us here. We've already paved the way. This is a great country to be in, and you will be treated as a welcome guest. And, you know, you won't be immediately asked to dress in a green outfit and put on a big hat and start looking for a pot of gold. So that's why the lyric is, you know, call them up, tell them we're all coming over. There'll be no shamrocks. There'll be no four-leaf clovers. You know, this will just be a great place for you to start again and start your life in the States and not to worry about stereotype ideas you may have of what it goes on here.
There will be a lot of audiences waiting to welcome you as you come over for your St. Paddy's Day tour. How's that going so far?
It's going great. We started in a very strange way in Alaska. We started at the very top of your country, and we had 10 amazing days up there that were just phenomenally well attended, and it's a great place to go because not a lot of bands go there, so you get a great welcome on top of the fact that they're glad. You know, maybe for you as a band individually, I think they're glad to have anybody. So it meant that we had great shows in really extreme weather, which added a whole craziness. We also shot a video while we were up there for We the Mighty, which will hopefully be coming out before the end of the month. And then we came back down and started working our way through the lower 48 now, and we're doing the Northwest. We're doing Colorado and the Rockies this week, and then we head into a crazy jumping all over the place St. Paddy's Day week, which will be the whole, you know, we'll be in Texas one day, Salt Lake the next day, L.A. the next day, San Diego. You know, it's kind of going all over the place, but that's how it always is at this time of the year. And then we'll have about 3 days off, and then we go straight to Europe, and we start our European run starting out in Ireland. So it'll go pretty much flat out until the middle of April, and then we'll get a chance to take a breather and see how it's going.
What can our Anaheim audience expect when you get down here on the 14th?
Well, you know, obviously, L.A. and Orange County, these are the areas the band started in, so it has a huge special place in our heart, always has had, and the Grove's a great venue, and we've got great bands. We've dipped into our past again, and we've got Brother, who was a band that played at my bar back in the early 90s when the band started. They were one of the bands that played with us, and so they've kind of regrouped in the last few years, and we found each other again, and so they're going to be there. Also a great local band called the Humble Hooligans. So we really handpicked the night to give it a very world music, definitely with a Celtic edge, but a more worldly than just having the same style of music all night long. You'll get a kick out of the Humble Hooligans, and you'll love what Brother do. There's just an Aboriginal, Celtic, Scottish blend in there, and we love the guys. We've done a lot of shows with them this year, and it's just a perfect match for us. And then we're bringing it, you know, like we hopefully always do. We've got about 6 songs from the new album, but we've got lots of songs from the Irish album, and we've got, you know, basically represent every record on the thing, but definitely giving it a very heavy Celtic slant for this time of the year. So you'll definitely get a full night of music.